Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast, in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. Muin Kate Dineen describes herself as a colour artist. She creates objects, blocks and bricks for example, in many shapes and sizes and in countless colours. Deep blood reds, delicate pinks, lapis blues, luscious greens and so on and so forth. They're often in vibrant combinations as well and striking contrasts. They're also minimal in detail and use an ancient tradition of fresco painting originating in India called Arash. It's a surface that's built up from many layers using marble dust, slaked lime and pigments. In a moment we'll find out how Kate discovered this process. Among her art objects are egg-shaped pieces called lingams, based on the stones that turn up in dried riverbeds which have been smoothed by years of being tossed around by water currents. More recently she's been using concrete as a medium too. Kate, who has a PhD from the Royal College of Art, collaborates on architectural projects overseas, such as with an Indian practice, Studio Mumbai. At home in her London studio, she produces artworks which have been displayed all over the world in solo and group shows. It's where I spoke with her. Kate, welcome to the podcast. I'm sitting in your studio. It's like a technicolour dream in here.
Yes, no, it is. There's a lot of colour. People are a bit gobsmacked when they first come in, I think, just to see, especially on a grey January day. You know, it's a bit of a kind of blast to your senses.
I mean, you know, there's just about every colour you've ever seen. There are jars of pigment powder. I mean, I can't think how many there are there.
Yeah, well, though, I don't know. I've lost count myself. It's tools of the trade. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's why I can't function without them. So.
And do you forage for the pigment?
Depends what you mean by the word forage. I mean, I get it from all over the place. I'm not actually digging around in the soil, but a lot of it are, I mean, there are loads of earth colours. There's lapis and malachite, and then I've got lots of synthetic pigments, and I mean, stuff from all over. Yeah. Basically, I have no sort of, I use whatever I can in order to get the colour that I want.
What is your favourite colour?
I don't have one. I mean, I think people ask that. I think, you know, it's combinations of colours that really do things for me, and, you know, certain balances of colours. But it would be impossible to say.
What is it about colour in general? I mean, is it because it's strikes the emotions?
Yeah, I think that's got such an emotive force, hasn't it, colour? And it's just the beauty of it, you know, or, you know, the way the light can affect colour, or there's something incredibly visceral about it. And the way people respond to colour, I mean, I've always loved it, always. And I used to do quite a lot of sort of figurative work, but gradually I sort of whittled it down to being more about colour than about anything else, really, or the way that you can utilise colour within certain medium and textures. And I don't know, it's just my vocabulary. It's how I articulate.
And you studied graphic design originally and textiles. Was colour very much to the fore then?
Well, it was. I mean, it has to be said, I was a kind of miserable failure when it came to graphic design. I went to the London College of Printing, which was kind of quite hardcore graphics, typographical course, and I kind of realized quite soon that what I loved there were all the printmaking facilities, amazing facilities there, you know, for making prints and etching and, you know, screen printing and all of that sort of stuff. And I discovered fairly quickly that that was my passion, and color and texture, and really not typography, and, you know, but they tolerated my presence because I worked quite hard. And for me, it was great because I could use all the equipment and kind of do what I wanted to do. They let me be.
Didn't you get a first class honours?
Well, I did, but I did. I mean, I think that it kind of pissed some people off. I think that there wasn't a single graphics thing in my show. So they, respect, hats off, and I was appreciative of that. The woman who ran that department actually got a guy from the Royal College to come in and assess my work because they said, we can't do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I'd gone to St Martin's for a little bit and I'd done these screen prints from St Martin's, and then it was all etching and I'd made books, but very little of it was related to a graphic design degree, you know. So they was they because they could see I'd not exactly been disappearing up my rectum. I hadn't been messing around, you know. So I think they thought, okay, we'll. And then the guy from the Royal College said to them, look, she should have a first.
I believe you were talking about Dan Fern then. Now, when did you decide, Kate, to go into sculpting?
Well, I haven't ever, and I'm still not. I'm not a sculptor.
How would you describe yourself then?
Very difficult question. I'm never quite sure. Yeah. I build blocks of colour. I'm a colour artist. I don't know what the fuck to say. Honestly, I never quite know. It sort of interfaces somewhere between painting and sculpture, but I'm not a sculptor. Never have been. You know, it's not how I'd describe myself.
And have you, you know, studied colour theory and that sort of thing?
No. I've just spent a lot of time in India, where I think you learn more about colour than anywhere else ever, you know, because there's a sort of extraordinary kind of anarchic, no-holds-barred, just inherent sense of colour, which, if you're receptive to that, and if you kind of have an empathy or an understanding, you can't help but pick up on it. So although, you know, I've spent endless years in kind of tip-top arts institutions, I was years at the Royal College of Art, you know, because I did a master's there in textiles, and then I got an extra year, and then I did a studio-based doctorate there, and blah, blah. So I've spent a lot of time, you know. But I think colour, I learnt just from opening my eyes.
Okay, well, we'll return to India in a minute. But you know, colour has a essential part of art history.
Yes.
Sometimes colours symbolise certain things.
Yeah.
I was talking to Antony Malinowski, the painter, recently.
Yeah.
And he was painting the interior of the Royal Court Theatre.
Right.
And he discovered, having looked at Roman frescoes, that the colour vermilion, or the very shades of vermilion, made the interior look bigger than it was. Have you found sort of things like that in colours?
Yeah, definitely with colour, and not only with the colour, but with the surface as well. So it's not only the colour, but it's the medium in which the colour occurs. So whether it's with plaster or whether it's a kind of lime wash or whether, you know, all those things actually massively affect the pigment or the pigmentation or how it receives and absorbs and reflects and deflects light. So I think its colour combined with surface has an enormous effect on space and the sense of space. And obviously colour itself, I mean if you use a deep vermilion or whatever it is, it's going to make a space, it's going to sort of shrink a space to a certain degree. If you have a different kind of colour, it's going to make the space feel more expansive. And I mean, I work actually with an architect in India, and I do colour on a much bigger scale there. I mean, not works of art, you know, walls and buildings. So I apply renders, or I select colours and make colour for renders on big spaces. And yes, absolutely, it can change a space dramatically.
You like walls, don't you?
I love walls. I love walls. Yeah, I do. So I've had a bit of an obsession about walls for a long time. I think that's why when I was doing etching, a lot of it was to do with fragmentation of colour and layering, and you can hand colour an etching and very deeply emboss the metal so that when you pull out the paper, it's almost like in relief, and the colour that it where it picks up on, you know, you have these fragments of really intense colour, which is a bit like a wall flaking. And if you use certain types of handmade papers that are very, you know, absorbent or rich or textured themselves, it's almost like, I think it's like fragmentation of a wall and that sense of time passing. And then obviously walls themselves, they layer, they decay, and that process of decay is in itself beautiful, you know, and what happens with colour and what happens with time. And, I mean, time makes art, doesn't it? You know, I use that a lot.
In 1988, you got this British Council residency grant.
Well, you've done your homework.
Yeah, wow. And to study Arash in India.
Yes.
Had you come across Arash before you went there?
That's why I went there, because when I was saying to you earlier, you know, I visited India, you know, just as a kind of, I first went there, I think I was about 17 when I first went there, just as a, you know, with a rucksack and And I saw actually that I'd sort of travelled and I'd seen in Rajasthan, which is obviously where everyone goes, real tourist hotspots. So I'd seen this incredibly beautiful surface in this Rajput architecture, very famous. Like in Jaipur, there's a very famous building called the Palace of the Winds, which is a sort of scalloped, extraordinary edifice in kind of that terracotta pink. But, you know, on the inside of that, there was this very beautiful polished surface, which for me, it was like, it was just so beautiful. And also in a palace outside Jaipur, there's a place called Amber Palace, Amber Fort, and very thick walls. And you'd walk along a corridor that was sort of polished ivory white, but sort of faded and decrepit, with this one black line following the sort of, I mean, very modernist, actually, beautiful, exquisite, minimal. And I wanted to know what that was, what that surface was. And so I made it my business to find out. And it was this Arash thing. Hence, I found out what it was. And then I found out who would be able to teach me how to do it, to make it.
Okay, so what did you find out about what it was?
I found out that it was a built surface. I found, I met some people fortuitously through the British Council who told me about, there's a very famous artist in India. He was called Subramaniam. And they said to me, you need to speak to the fresco artist who worked with Subramaniam, because he's a kind of expert master craftsman on all different types of frescoes. Subramaniam didn't use this. He used kind of sandblasting, more modern things. But they said, go find this guy. He works in Gujarat in Baroda, where there's a big famous art college. And this guy taught fresco there, this old guy. So I took a train to Baroda. And when I arrived there, I just walked in, you know, looking for this chap. And I went to the art department and I saw a fresco of a very beautiful, polished black elephant, which kind of made my heart beat fast, because I thought, oh, my God. It's that beautiful surface, more figurative actually than I was used to seeing, but that same thing. And there was this guy there, old guy, and he was just sitting there in his dhoti with his beady hanging out, and I just tried to talk to him. He spoke broken English. I spoke no Hindi and absolutely no Marwadi, which was his local dialect, because he's a Rajasthani guy. But anyway, somehow we managed, and I said to him, I went back, you know, I said hi, blah, 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 and he couldn't give a toss, really. And then I went back the next day and said, look, I just, you know, would I be able to come and learn this from you? And he was like, yeah, whatever. I mean, I think people come and go, and he was sort of indifferent then, fine, you know. So then I basically went back to England, and I can't remember how exactly it happened, but anyway, I got this British Council scholarship thing to go back out there and learn. So I had to get approvals, and I had to make sure that Baroda would be prepared for me to. I'd actually done my master's. I was finishing my MA at the RCA at that point, I think. So I went out there to do this British Council scholarship and work with this man called Garcia Lalvarma after I'd done my MA at the RCA.
So what is the process exactly? You start off with marble dust, I think, don't you?
Yes. So what it is, it's a fresco process. So it was a way traditionally of finishing off a building. So essentially the buildings with Rajput architecture, they're stone. So what it is you'd build on top of the stone, there's like a brick dust mortar render, which is like a sort of absorbent cushion, and then you apply this fresco process, which is marble dust and slate lime, hydrated lime, and you grind it into a sort of aggregate. That's what this thing's there, Chucky. You grind it up. The marble dust, different grades of marble dust and lime, and you form a sort of aggregate cement, almost like a cement mix, which has its own weirdly integral strength. Lime is a very strong binder. And then you build that up in lots of layers. It's crazily laborious. And you grind each layer sort of three times with water, and you build it up and you build it up, you let layers dry, you start again when it's dry with more layers, you let it dry. So you build up layers, and essentially it's basically like building another layer of stone on top of the wall. And then what you can do, or what I have done, is I've built pigment. So I've sort of customized that process,
right,
essentially. So you can also build pigment into those layers. So it's a bit like building colour. It's like making your own stone. That's the only way I can sort of describe it. Or another way, I think Chinese lacquer works quite similar, because you're building up very, very many layers. There are about 25 layers And you're grinding, you're sort of grinding colour into colour. So it's a way of building a very pure block of colour. And I think I sort of made it work for me because I'm passionate about colour and I love that wall surface. And I somehow wanted to try and combine the two.
So all your dreams come into one there.
Exactly. Exactly. Which is why, because I'm a bit of a, you know, I mean, at the Royal, I worked in lots of different departments. You know, I was printmaking, I was textiles, I was sculptor, but this has managed to hold my focus and my attention for 30 odd years. You know,
and with such a labour-intensive process,
yeah, it's insane,
you're quite a small
build.
No,
but look, feel that.
Oh, you've got biceps.
I've got serious fucking biceps. It's solid. Yeah, yeah. So it's everything.
No need for the gym for you.
It's all, well, I actually swim every morning as well, just in case. Yeah, to keep it going. You know, to try and I swim out. I swim every morning. But I mean, everything is heavy in here because you grind the pigment. I have stone pestle and mortars, marble pestle and mortars, in which I grind the pigment with the lime. And then I have this stone granite, like a granite chucky, which is what they grind maize and mealy with in African India. You know, it's one of these big. So I ship those things back from India and I have to grind that to make the marble dust and lime, the paste, which forms the kind of substrate. It's what builds all these blocks, basically. So it's an incredibly physical process. And quite time consuming. So I think you have to, it's very process led, this thing. So while you're doing all that stuff, you've got time to sort of, in your brain, you have time to think about what you're doing. And because I'm quite physical, it kind of suits me that while I'm not sitting there like twiddling my thumbs and looking into the distance, wondering what I'm doing, that's because there's a lot I have to do in order to create the things I want to create. So that process of making gives me the time to think, what the hell am I doing? So it's quite an important, there's time while you're making and building and grinding. You have time to formulate in your brain exactly what it is you want to be doing.
Okay, well, let's have a look at some of the things that you have been doing. I mean, there are various blocks of colorful objects.
That's the unusual thing, you know. For example, I mean, this it's a wool finish, so they never used to make objects from this. You know, it was a way of finishing off a building. So the fact that I've made objects and I've cut holes, you see, like there are lots of perforations and holes with light passing through, or I've actually, some bits are still wrapped up from the show, but there are other pieces where I've set like bits of metal in. And I remember Garcia, he was quite, because I worked with him, having met him, having done that period of time with him, you know, the scholarship, I lived there for 3 years, so I was in and out of his house, so he basically took me on,
right.
You know, he took me on completely.
There can't be many women over there. You're the only one.
Women don't do it. It's not allowed. So when I turned up, you know, sort of female white, that was a bit of an anomaly, you know. It was a bit of a, I mean women have learnt it under his tuition in art college, but not carried it on. It was just part of the course. They had to do a kind of token 2 week, 3 week bit, you know. But in terms of the, you know, seriously doing this as a profession, it was a male, followed a male lineage. So father to son within a very particular caste.
And
so
do his sons do it then?
No, they weren't interested. They were doing like printing business, or they couldn't be asked to do this. You know, it's hard work, and there wasn't, you know, there used to be the Maharaja's workshops, basically, that used to fund all this work, and that obviously post 1947, that they didn't exist, you know, and they don't really have money anymore. So there wasn't the financial backing or support to pursue work like this. So then it became something that only kind of very erudite, arty types might bother to do if they were trying to restore a building, or just not enough work there to provide livelihoods for people anymore.
I suppose your friendship with Mr. Balmer would have helped counter any gender bias, I guess.
He was so open. He was very cool, you know. So his sons were much more kind of much more limited than he was. He didn't care if I was black, white, pink, male, female, somewhere in the middle. He couldn't give a toss, really. So what he liked was the fact that I was receptive and keen and interested, and I wanted to learn, and I was quite good at, you know, I understood what he was telling me.
It's a funny thing, Kate, isn't it, that when you go to
places like India and Africa. They're so colourful in the way people, what they wear the houses and everything.
Yeah.
But yet here in the West, we're rather muted, aren't we?
I think that we're scared of colour. I mean, I think that people are really self-conscious about any kind of level of expression in terms of colour or flamboyancy, or, you know, you're going to get labelled, or it's not part of our culture. I don't know if it's to do with the light. I don't know if it's to do with... I don't know why. I don't know why it is.
We have this word garish, don't we, which we use.
Yeah, I think garish and tasteless. And I mean, colour can be hideous and it can be garish. And I think maybe if it's not built into our kind of genetic culture to be able to deal with colour. I mean, you get fantastic thing, you know, like in Mexico and lots of architecture. I mean, people like Scarpa. I mean, people, you know, do use colour in architecture and use it in a wonderful way. I just think that we don't seem to, it doesn't seem to be part of our cultural inheritance. Yet it was. If you look back at sort of Renaissance, you know, the way people coloured their houses, you know, I mean, we used all sorts of beautiful colours. So I don't know what happened. I don't know where it went. Was it the Industrial Revolution? Was it, I don't know what happened. But somehow we lost it along the way. And it's quite hard getting it back again. And, you know, I work a lot with an architect in India. I've worked with a few architects in the UK, but people are scared of colour. They think you're just going to fuck up their beautiful clean lines and their minimal, you know, with your colour. But actually, if you do colour well and beautifully, it can but enhance. I remember when people used to start planting fields of rape. Do you remember mustard rape? And it was this incredible yellowy, and people complained about fields of rape because they found that sort of an assault on your senses, the colour. I was like, wow, beautiful. You know, you get a leaden grey sky and then this extraordinary field of rape, this kind of mustard yellow, and it was beautiful. I remember my mother thinking that was beautiful, but here it was slammed.
Anyway, we're awash with colour here in your studio.
We are awash with colour, and people find it quite, when, if ever I do like an open studio and people walk in out of the blue, you know, if people are just wandering around randomly, so they haven't come here specifically, it's just random, and people walk in and they're like, oh my god, you can sort of pee people stop, they you know, because you just, people aren't used to seeing this much colour.
When you think of artists and colour, the one name that comes up all the time is Rothko, isn't it? Was he an influence?
Obviously, you know, I mean, the way he deals with colour is extraordinary. I went to see a show of his recently, and it was really in Paris. It was interesting because there was a lot of his early work, which he'd sort of done more figurative painting. And in fact, I mean, it was okay. It wasn't the painting that was so great in those early things. It was the way he'd used colour, you know, in those figurative paintings. And there was people, there was self-portrait, which actually was great. But it was his use of colour and...
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at two of your large blocks here in very Rothko colours. They're quite contemplative. Is that what you find?
Yes. I mean, I think what I'm interested in with colour is so that your peripheral vision is completely encompassed by this. And they are quite meditative. You know, I want people to get sort of lost in the colour or consumed by the colour. And so, in a way, you know, physically, the bigger the piece, the more imposing in a way it is. And that relationship between the viewer and the viewed, as it were, you know, I want them to be quite imposing. So the fact is, you know, those, I mean, they're bigger than me, they're taller than me. But and when I set them up, I showed them in a gallery in New York, and I just had them on acrylic bricks. So they were just slightly leaning, obviously chained up at the back so that they're safe. But then when you're standing in front of it, they're basically, you know, the same height as you, but they're much bigger and they're broader and they're quite powerful. And I just want that connection between, that physical connection between the person who's standing in front of them and the colour, and for them to be sucked in by it.
Well, around us here, we've got objects that you've made. They're bricks. There are lotus shapes, star shapes.
Stars, flowers. I don't like stars.
Lotus flowers.
Yeah.
What determines your choice of shape when you're starting something?
I think something that seems quite timeless. You know, I use this egg shape quite a lot, and that's based around, you know, lingams. I collect these very beautiful lingams, which are a sort of they represent the phallus in India. I mean, they're called Shiva Lingams. And I just think shapes which aren't tied to particularly a specific time or a place or a genre, I like those shapes to be a vehicle for the colour and for the texture. I suppose it's also to do with the sort of tactile quality, curves. You know, like everything I make, nothing has sharp corners. They're sort of moulded corners, as it were. So there's a sort of softness, I think, even to just the square, even just to the blocks.
Well, you say lingams of like phalluses, with curves we normally associate with the feminine, so there's a kind of balance there, isn't
there? There's a balance, and in fact that egg, you know, obviously the egg is also, you know, because it represents fertility and new life, birth, blah. So for me it's a fantastic shape because it encompasses all, the male, the female, life, birth, diddler, you know, and I think that's why I keep doing it over and over again. And what's interesting actually is when people come into the studio, they are very tactile. The big ones are hard to hold, but the smaller ones, and the way men hold those lingams, those eggs, is quite interesting.
Well,
they cradle.
What, cradle them?
Yeah. They cradle them almost more than women do. I've noticed in here, you know, you pass it to a man, they're quite tentative. Men are quite tentative about holding them, but I just like pass it to people so they have to hold it, otherwise it's going to fall on the floor. But men are quite, they cradle it, which is, I always find quite interesting. Right. Yeah.
You've got various drawings that you make as well. What one that interests me actually, though we're sitting near it here, is a lapis lazuli silver hands and feet. So these occur in one or two of your pieces, don't they?
Yeah, there are many references. People use the hand symbol a lot. And for example, you know, when a woman's committed sati, which is self-immolation, you know, it has become a kind of place of pilgrimage, and people come and they make handprints. For me, that's a bit of a, you know, because would you want somewhere where somebody's set themselves on fire to be a point of pilgrimage? I don't know. But, you know, hands, they have quite, it's quite an ambivalent symbol for me, the hands. But also they're beautiful. And again, universal and timeless. Likewise, feet. I mean, often people use feet as Vishnu's footprints in Hindu religion, Hindu spiritual mythology, but again, for me, there's something quite universal and goes beyond boundaries, hands and feet. And they're very beautiful shapes. They're also etched. In fact, if you look at them, they're etched and they have kind of patterns and symbols within. But I think I leave it up to people. That's what interests me. But I don't want to just come out with a whole load of kind of shit. You know, it's up to people how they interpret that. That they interest me for my own personal experience, my own personal journey, where I've been, what I've seen, what speaks to me. But, you know, they could appeal to people for, you know, or speak to people for entirely different reasons.
And what about these? There's some white bricks here with
blocks blue, with blue lapis again. That's lapis.
And what do those shapes?
They're shapes. So they're all wombs. They're different wombs or cervix, or you know, they're different parts of the female anatomy. That one there, and yeah, and some people think it looks like people with their legs open, or you know, but it's quite. They could be leaves. You know, I did some red ones, which were definitely very vaginal, and one guy came in and thought it was a coffee bean. So do you know what? It's how people read things and interpret them. But those are quite specifically drawings and pictures of the female uterus and the womb, because I find those shapes very beautiful. I'm not kind of trying to make a big kind of feminist statement. I just find those shapes beautiful. And I also love lapis. So I love the quality of lapis, and it's quite rough and stone-like, and there's a kind of solidity to it. So I quite like the combination of that solidity with the fragility of those shapes.
One material that surprised me when I read that you used is concrete.
Yeah, I love concrete.
Yeah, it's not a material that I normally associate with sculpture. How did you discover its qualities, and what are they?
Well, it's probably working with Studio Mumbai. I've worked with Studio Mumbai for about 30 years. So, you know, I started off my relationship with them with using fresco. But, you know, it's a very difficult process to use. It's very difficult to find enough people to work with me on site if you're covering large areas, because when I'm working with Bidjoy Jane, who's the architect, or when we're working together, we're doing quite large-scale projects. So just me on my own isn't sufficient. You need a... So basically, we had to find another way, another process that could carry the colour that I do, that wasn't so precious, so difficult, so problematic. Cement plasters and all that sort of thing, and concrete. I mean, it's, you know, you see it, it's a beautiful material, it's just not used in a very beautiful way often. But when you cast concrete, and people do it now, it's trendy, and, you know, but you can incorporate colour in that, and it's I liked it because it's sort of cheap universal material, and the fresco that I'm used to doing is very precious and very not cheap and very not universal. It's kind of particular, so I just thought, okay, that's the sort of antithesis to what I usually do. But in fact, because I'm so particular about colour and surface, I ended up making the concrete almost as difficult as the fresco, because I wanted a certain quality from it. You know, so I had to find ways of pouring the concrete so I could get beautiful surface, beautiful colour. You have to work quickly with it.
I notice you do some corrugated objects with it, don't you? And that I think gives another advantage in that, in the indentations, you get a shadow and you get a change of colour, so it gives it a bit more
breadth. It's beautiful, the corrugated, and I did that because, again, it was a project I was doing with Studio Mumbai, and we did a big installation in the Victoria and Albert Museum, which was Bidjoy's. Basically, it was the studio, it was near where he worked, and he inverted a space. And it was where people had lived for generations. And obviously people use all sorts of recycled materials and corrugated plastic or corrugated metal or whatever. And so we cast that all up in plaster. And so I wanted to do this whole concrete series. And concrete obviously is very permanent. And there's a transience and a throwaway quality to all those materials that people were using. So I was just reversing that and incorporating my colour into it. And they became very solid. A series, actually. I did a series in different colours.
What are you working on at the moment, Kate?
I'm doing some commission work. I've got to go back to India quite soon. And then, I mean, it's an ongoing process. So for the next show, I keep going, keep going, keep going, you know.
Keep going and keep going. Thanks a lot for talking. It's been fantastic.
No, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
The colourful Kate Dineen there, bringing an end to this week's Considering Art podcast. I hope you can join me, Bob Chaundy, again next week.